Alt NPR.
The following is an excerpt from Benjamin Walker's Theory of Everything. For more information, visit toeradio.org.
So I worked at greatsystems.com for about 2 years. When I started, there were 75 people, and at our peak, we had about 2,000. I was in the operations department, which, you know, meant that we looked out for the network. We kept customers up and running. We had about 4,000 customers. I was going in about 7 in the morning most days and staying until at least 6 or 7 at night, sometimes 8 or 9. I was busy. I was working, you know, 12, 13-hour days. What we basically did in operations is this. After the sales would make the sale, the order would pop over to us. We would place an order with Verizon, and we would have Verizon go out there, do the outside wire, and from there it was us. So, you know, we were routing IPs. We were designating where the line would go to, how fast it would go. We, in effect, controlled the entire network and all of 4,000 lines that we had out there. It was a lot of work, but I was committed to it heart and soul. And although I loved doing it, I knew, or at least I thought, that the outcome was going to be me not having to work again. I really saw this as a gold rush, and I saw myself as being there at the right time. At the end of 4 years, I was going to cash in all of my stocks, and, you know, I would, at the age of 30, I wouldn't have to work again. I mean, that, I think that probably goes a long way in explaining the kind of commitment and the way I was so devoted to this job. But, things didn't work out like that. About 2 months before they let me go, the CEO sat me down, and he said, "You were around when we were bringing this network up. You probably alone brought up at least 1,000 of these customers. And we're going to keep you around for another month and a half. And we want you to bring these people down." This was probably worse news than if they had told me to just go home that day and not come back. I mean, you know, this is like telling somebody who's just created this great piece of work to erase it. To wreck it. In effect, what they were telling me was, "We want to keep you around for a month and a half to erase evidence that you were ever there." About 3/4 of the company was told to go and not come back. They were given a small severance package, told to clean out their desks and go. Them keeping me there for a month and a half was good in one way, because it gave me time to think about what I was going to do next. And I certainly didn't know, because I'd never planned to be in a situation like that. You know, like I said before, I thought it would be 4 years and then not have to work again, you know, laying on the beach somewhere. But now, suddenly things had turned. You know, the world had gone from light to dark. And when the last day came, if you remember that storm we had about 2 months ago, the nor'easter. Well, that was my last day at greatsystems.com. I didn't even have to do work, actually. I just went in, signed a couple forms, cleaned out my desk, and that was it. I was just lost. I needed to find a place where I could spend my days. Until I moved on to something else, and it just seemed like a natural decision. You know, what better place than the Boston Public Library? One of the very first things I noticed was the library was filled with young people. I mean, and the only conclusion I could come to was that these were people like me, who had been affected by the massive layoffs, the dot-com tech slumps. The library, very strangely, had a gravitational pull on people in situations like mine. I remember the last time I was at the library on just a regular day during the week. There were no young people at all. It was homeless people. It was the elderly. You know, it was like, it was, you know, your odd student here and there, but certainly not, you know, young professionals like myself. And on that very first day, I couldn't even find a table to sit in. I just kind of like, you know, made a little home for myself in the corner, you know, right next to one of the stacks. And from there on, I was at the library the minute they opened. I would read for about 2 hours at a time and take a cigarette break. And there was one fellow in particular, Sam, who always seemed to be out there smoking. I think we were just on the same schedule. And I started talking to him, and sure enough, you know, he had been an engineer for a dot-com company, and he had been laid off as well. And Sam and I became kind of friendly, and he was often there when the library opened as well. You know, he knew like me that if you weren't there when it opened, you might not get a table. So Sam and I, we started sharing the same table, and as we found out, we had the same aspirations when we worked for these dot-com companies. And, you know, he even thought to himself, same thing, 4 years, and he wouldn't have to work again. You know, and in his words, this is how he put it to me. His religion had been revealed as a false one. You see, this had happened to Sam a few months before it happened to me. And so Sam was further along in his planning for the next step. And he was really in tune with where he was going to go from here. He started pushing books my way. He started pushing literature my way. And, you know, he slowly became more open in talking to me about what his plans were. And, you see, Sam and a group of Sam's ex-coworkers and friends, they were going to be starting a dot commune. This is what they were going to be calling it, a dot commune. It was going to be a commune loosely organized around the idea that the tech world, the world of computers, hadn't worked out for them. It was more or less a home for people who had been screwed in the rat race, you know, and they were going to take the beneficial parts of working in that world and transfer them over to their own utopia. They were going from, in essence, they were moving from one utopia to another. Because let's be honest about it. I mean, the whole dot-com thing was its own kind of utopia. So it makes sense, and it makes sense to me that they were just gravitating to another kind of utopia. From dot-com to dot-commune. I expressed a lot of interest to Sam that this seemed like it might be the right thing for me. I think this might be what I was looking to fill the void that GreatSystems.com had left. And Sam was thinking the same thing. I mean, you know, I think he'd almost recruited me. I was somebody that he preyed upon. And you know what? I'm happy that he preyed on me. Sam had to take my case to the other dot commies, and he had to present it to them. It was going to be a panel discussion. It was going to be kind of a formal event where he presented my case, who I was, what I thought about things, what had happened to me, and as well as that, I had to write up my own proposal on why I should be in this dot commune. And it had to be about 3 pages long, and I was very serious about it. I took a whole day there at the library. I became very interested in communal life. The people in the country who had communes, I was very interested in what their grievances were, what their agendas were. At Sam's suggestion, I even read about the Paris commune and why it failed. You know, he said this would be a good idea because it would help to ensure the success of our future commune. So I did that too. I wrote up this proposal. I don't know, probably a week or two passed, and one morning Sam was late showing up, and this wasn't like him at all. And when he finally did come to the library, he marched right up to my table. He was beaming, and he said, "Tom, you're in." You know, and at that time he told me that 18 other members, or potential members, had been rejected. So the odds were against me, but they were all very impressed, in particular by my three-page paper on why I should be a member of the dot commune. You know, I wrote about what had happened to me at my former job, you know, and I included some of the things I had learned recently in reading about communes. I talked about the way I saw the world. I talked about, you know, who the people were that got screwed in the dot-com world and who the people were that were doing the screwing. You know, and I guess, you know, I didn't know this at the time, but I was using their language. I was saying the things that they were saying already in my paper, and this is why they liked it so much. You know, it was something coming from one of them. So the following Sunday, I was invited into the group at their weekly meeting, and it turned out to be a very, very important meeting. That night, we drafted up our manifesto concerning where we would set up our dot commune. Can I read it to you?
Sure.
All right, it goes like this. Number one, first and foremost, the place we have chosen must be secluded, and nobody is to live within a 5-mile radius of the place to be selected. There are innumerable reasons for this, but mainly because we so disagree with the outside world, we should agree on being as far from it as humanly possible. Likewise, we have to count on the fact that the outside world would strongly disagree with the path we've picked, so we want to spare them from witnessing our revolutionary and fascinating living arrangements. Number two, although we have just pledged to sever contact with the outside world, we understand that we need to leave ourselves with the option of mingling and using the outside world when we feel it's necessary. For this reason, our location will be no further than a 10-minute drunken stumble from a bus or train stop. Also, since most drunken stumbles take place late at night, the public transportation must run around the clock, preferably every 10 minutes. Number three, the location and residence must be able to accommodate for our version of a dot communal financial district. This might be set up outdoors and might manifest itself as nothing more than a dilapidated shack wherein strictly financial matters are to occur, or, on the other hand, it might simply be a room we set aside for these matters. Nonetheless, we must have a specific place that we are able to refer to as a financial district. After time, we expect to be able to project a mirage of very tall buildings that will at least create an acceptable version of financial districts scattered throughout the world. Number four, because most of us have problems with authority, and because the police are the ultimate symbols of authority, we take a firm stance that police, and for that matter authority in any form, are mostly just not necessary. We don't want someone clubbing us on the noggin for reasons they don't understand, and for reasons that we think are completely illegitimate. Although it's true that people look good in uniform, it is our position that the only uniformed governmental agents with business in our residential neighborhood should be postal workers, with exceptions for the occasional garbage man.
There's no way you're going to find a place like that.
We're all looking full-time.
Been listening to an excerpt from Benjamin Walker's Theory of Everything, written and produced by Thomas Gilmore and Benjamin Walker. For more information, an audio archive, and a blog, visit toeradio.org.
Alt.